Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this edition of the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni. Today we begin with Jill Bevilacqua's weekly reflection, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
After the crowds had their fill, Jesus insisted that his disciples get into the boat and precede him to the other side. When he'd sent them away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray, remaining there alone as evening drew on. Meanwhile, the boat, already several hundred yards out from shore, was being tossed about in the waves raised by strong headwinds. At about 3 a.m, he came walking toward them on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the water, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and in their fear they began to cry out. Jesus hastened to reassure them. "Get hold of yourselves, it is I. Do not be afraid." Peter spoke up and said, "Lord, if it is really you, tell me to come to you across the water." "Come," he said. So Peter got out of the boat and began to walk on the water, moving toward Jesus. But when he perceived how strong the wind was, becoming frightened, he began to sink and cried out, "Lord, save me!" Jesus at once stretched out his hand and caught him. "How little faith you have," he exclaimed. "Why did you falter?" Once they had climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Those who were in the boat showed him reverence, declaring, "Beyond doubt, you are the Son of God."
The Gospel for today opens in our version with a phrase shown in brackets, which serves as an introduction. But why is it followed then by Jesus insisting that the disciples get into the boat and precede him to the other side? We find the explanation in St. John's Gospel, after his account of the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000.
The people, seeing this sign that he had given, said, "This really is the prophet who is come into the world." Jesus, who could see they were about to come and take him by force and make him king, escaped back to the hills by himself.
A scholar comments that although the miraculous sign has what seems at first a positive effect, this is received by Jesus with reserve. In fact, of itself, the acclamation of him as prophet and king would be a recognition of his messianic reality.
But the crowd's declaration is made in a nationalistic and socio-political perspective, which Jesus does not accept. This is why he withdraws away from the enthusiasm of the people.
Writes another.
Mark also lets it be understood that this was a critical moment. Jesus sent the disciples away, tried to escape from the crowd, and then prayed. And immediately he obliged his disciples to go up into the ship, that they might go before him over the water to Bethsaida, whilst he dismissed the people. And when he had dismissed them, he went up to the mountain to pray.
There's something of an anomaly in this account of Mark's. We know that Jesus and the disciples are already on the side of the lake near Bethsaida. And in fact, John, who was certainly there, writes,
"That evening the disciples went down to the shore of the lake and got into a boat to make for Capernaum on the other side of the lake."
Was Peter somewhat confused when he recounted this episode to Mark? It was certainly a dramatic episode, and Peter himself plays a leading part in it. But Mark does not recount this, for Peter, in his humility, does not wish to draw the attention to himself. But let's pick up where we left off. Jesus has managed to get rid of the crowds and has returned up the hill to pray. One feels he must have desperately needed the contact with his Father at this moment. No one else can do. Meanwhile, the disciples are struggling to make some headway across the lake. But the wind is against them, and by about 3 a.m, they have still made only 3 or 4 miles. 25 or 30 furlongs, writes John. In our gospel today, we heard of several hundred yards out from shore, tossed about in the waves raised by strong headwinds. For although the fishing boat had sails, they were unable to hoist them because of the contrary wind and had to depend on their oars. From his hilltop, Jesus saw that they were battling with a heavy sea, and Mark writes,
"He could see they were worn out with rowing, and about the fourth watch of the night he came towards them, walking on the lake."
Both Matthew and Mark use the phrase "the fourth watch," which for us is translated as "about 3 in the morning." The Hebrews divided the night into 4 watches. The first was at dusk, the second at midnight, sometimes referred to as the middle watch. The third was when the cock crows, or simply at cockcrow. The fourth, at early dawn or dawning, referred here as the morning watch. And immediately the words of the De Profundis, the 129th Psalm, come to mind.
"From the morning watch, even until night, let Israel hope in the Lord."
Or, as the more modern version has it,
"My soul is longing for the Lord, more than watchmen for daybreak. Let the watchman count on daybreak, and Israel on the Lord."
The watchman was an essential figure always, and is mentioned in yet another psalm.
"If the Lord does not watch over the city, in vain does the watchman keep vigil."
And so, in the fourth watch of the night, he went towards them, walking on the lake. And Mark, who is writing for Peter, inserts this phrase, "He was going to pass them by." What does this mean exactly? Peter is remembering that night, and perhaps that was the impression he had. And after all, we have to remember that when the disciples saw Jesus in the distance, they were terrified. If someone was walking on the water, it could only be a ghost. And this is what they cry out. In their fear, as Matthew writes, and fear works on the imagination. But Jesus doesn't leave them in that terrified state. He hastened to reassure them. "Courage, it is I. Do not be afraid." What happened next? Of the 3 evangelists who recount this episode, only Matthew adds the incident of Peter walking on the water. After quoting our Lord's words of encouragement, Mark writes simply,
"Then he got into the boat with them, and the wind dropped. They were utterly and completely dumbfounded, because they had not seen what the miracle of the loaves meant. Their minds were closed."
And a scholar comments,
"Jesus dominates the dark forces of chaos and of evil with his omnipotent control, which, however, is hidden from the eyes of the disciples, who are disturbed, but whose hearts are hardened."
Perhaps the Jerusalem Bible version, "their minds were closed," renders the idea better. And another scholar writes,
"Mark stresses the contrast between the sovereign power of Jesus and the fear of the disciples, who had not realized that it was Jesus."
In John's account, the words of Jesus are followed by this statement,
"They were for taking him into the boat, but in no time it reached the shore, at the place they were making for."
And commenting on this, our scholar writes,
"At the center of this manifestation of Jesus as Lord of being and of nothingness, the waters are the symbol of chaos, conquered by God in the creation, there is the solemn declaration, 'It is I,' which recalls the revelation of the divine name to Moses on Sinai in the burning bush, 'I am who I am.' There is also a repetition of the symbol of the sea crossed by Israel in the liberating Exodus and a reference to Psalm 77. You strode across the sea, you marched across the ocean, but your steps could not be seen." So we are shown the divine dimension of Jesus and his ability to be present among us by another way than that which is purely physical and material.
And so to the extraordinary moment which Matthew presents, when, as Sheed puts it,
Peter emerges from the anonymity of the group for the first time since the apostles were chosen. Till this moment, there'd been nothing in the 9 months since then to single him out from the rest.
Matthew, who was present in the boat, tells us clearly that Peter spoke up. In another version,
"It was Peter who answered, 'Lord, if it is you, tell me to come to you across the water.' And Jesus said, 'Come.' So Peter got out of the boat and began to walk on the water."
And Piero Bargellini interprets the scene.
In that gesture, in those words, there is the whole of Peter, all the impulsiveness and at the same time the weakness of the Galilean fisherman, which make of him such a sincere, such a human figure, different from all the others. Simon Peter was a seaman, so he feared the treachery of the waves and the inconsistency of the winds. And yet, while the others trembled, he had the courage to entrust himself to a test which is inconceivable for a sailor. The sailor fights to the last inside his nutshell. His world is not the sea, it's the boat. Beyond the confines of the boat is the water, the dominion of the wave, over which he has no power. The ablest of seamen in the handling of the boat is never so presumptuous as to think he can control the sea. We have to think of this in order to understand how great was the faith of that man who lived his life on the restless waves and who asks Jesus, "Tell me to come to you across the water." Only by forgetting himself and the whole of his experience was he able to say this. And then the act of climbing out of the boat to walk on the water was simply madness beyond the imagination of any sailor. At that moment, Peter is outside any norm of prudence. He's beside himself. He doesn't consider whether it's advisable, appropriate, or safe. He only obeys the command of Jesus. And in doing this, he once more stands out distinctly from all the others. Paradoxically, in him, the future head of the church is proclaimed. His action, inexplicable in human terms, explains better than any other in the history of the church the conduct of his successors, which considerations of prudence, of wisdom, of diplomacy, of astuteness never fully explain. At a certain point, there's always that stepping outside the boat. In other words, the act which is beyond human justification and is only obedience to the Lord's command.
And so Peter steps out of the boat and begins to walk on the water. But then he looks down and sees the blackness of the waves and feels the violence of the wind. And as Bargellini comments,
"Bit by bit, the anxieties of the sailor got the better of the faith of the apostle. He began to feel his feet, his ankles, his knees entangled by the water. He was sinking."
And a few lines from a man who died in 1900 and who remains, I quote, "a controversial figure, as misunderstood today as he was in his own day." Oscar Wilde. His poem, E Tenebris, opens like this.
"Come down, O Christ, and help me. Reach thy hand, for I am drowning in a stormier sea than Simon on thy lake of Galilee."
Wilde's Heart of Stone, runs the comment on this poem, was broken in Reading Jail, and although doubts persisted right until the very end, he was finally received into the Catholic Church on his deathbed.
"My heart is as some famine-murdered land, when all good things have perished utterly, and well I know my soul in hell must lie, if I this night before God's throne should stand. Nay, peace I shall behold before the night, the feet of brass, the robe more white than flame, the wounded hands, the weary human face."
Peter, in his fear and humanity, beginning to sink, had no doubts as to who could help him, and to whom he cried out, Lord, help me. And Bargellini concludes.
The reproof of Jesus, why did you doubt, O man of little faith, is not an accusation of weak faith. It's an observation, a statement of the fact of human weakness, and emphasizes the act of great faith, when Peter, and only he, entrusted himself to God, like one who is absent-minded, abandoning the boat and separating himself, not only materially from all his companions, who stayed as they were, holding on to the bulkheads and shrouds of the boat.
And let's close with the celebrated hymn for those in peril on the sea. Eternal Father, strong to save, whose arm doth bind the restless wave, who bids the mighty ocean deep its own appointed limits keep, O hear us when we cry to thee for those in peril on the sea.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who produced and presented There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. And now for our weekly programme, Joan Knows, we listen to a summer special prepared by Sister Janet Ferns, currently press officer for the Pontifical Mission Societies, but until just a few months ago, a colleague of ours here at Vatican Radio's English feature programme. She sat down with our resident Vatican expert, Joan Lewis, to talk about one of Rome's less famous basilicas.
Joan Knows. Conversations with Joan Lewis.
Well, Joan, for our summer special, we're visiting a basilica that many people don't get to visit.
And it's really a shame. It is so beautiful, so steeped in history. It just doesn't happen to be in the exact precise center of Rome as a St. Mary Major or St. Peter's might be. And we're talking about the Basilica of St. Lawrence outside the walls. Even St. Paul's outside the walls is better known, of course. The people at the Basilica told me it is also considered, St. Lawrence's, one of the patriarchal basilicas. Normally, the number 4 comes up with the term patriarchal basilica. But this church is really kind of a two-for-one treat, because what you have, the original church, again, we go back to the Emperor Constantine, who very much liked the story of St. Stephen, of St. Lawrence, because St. Stephen is also in this. He loved the story of St. Lawrence, who was a deacon and a martyr, and actually, when he found his body, decided to build a basilica to protect the tomb where St. Lawrence was, and then to build a basilica around. He was a great basilica builder, as we have seen from our history. So St. Lawrence's tomb was originally in an area known as Ager Veranus. It was land owned by a gentleman, Lucius Verus. Anyway, today on that property is the Verano Cemetery, a very big, beautiful cemetery in Rome. And the Church of St. Lawrence, the Basilica, is also known as the St. Lawrence at the Verano. But to go back to the basilica, why do I say it's like a two-for-one treat? It's almost a three-for-one treat, because you have the original Constantinian basilica. Then another one was built by Pope Pelagius, 579 to 590, when he was pope, because he kind of saw the decay of the first basilica. And then later you have Pope Honorius, 1216 to 1227, seeing the decay of the previous ones and adding on to that.
And Honorius was the pope who was around when St. Francis of Assisi was around, and he was the one who had the dream about rebuilding the church. and getting Francis to help him.
Indeed. I had forgotten about that association, but that's the exact same time frame. Now, I mentioned earlier, by mistake, St. Stephen, but we do have to the Church of Constantine, over the tomb of the saint, we did have the body of St. Stephen brought, and then later St. Justin. So those three are entombed in the Basilica of St. Lawrence outside the walls. And what you have really are two churches, in the sense that we said that Pope Honorius in the 13th century had this grandiose project to expand and embellish the existing churches. And what he did, in the previous church, there was a famous, beautiful, striking, triumphal arch, which most of your major basilicas had or have today. And what he did, he took that as his departure point, and he proceeded to build a new church out and away from the triumphal arch. So the two basilicas are joined, as I wrote in my book, kind of like Siamese twins, and they're joined at the triumphal arch. So when you enter the basilica, you're in the church built by Honorius. You proceed up the center aisle to a point where there's steps directly below the triumphal arch, and once you ascend these steps, you are then in the Pelagian basilica. So what is fascinating about this is to see you have the 300s Constantine, 500s Pelagius, and then the medieval Honorius. The different architectures, the windows, the stories, the columns, the diversity of the columns, the floors. I mean, it really is like walking into two entirely different churches where you assume once there was a wall in the middle and somebody took it down. They're just so different. And one of the most striking things, I guess maybe I noticed it stood out as a woman. In the Pelagian Basilica, to make a lot of light come in the church, there were, to render it more luminous, there was a series of arched windows on the main level, as well as the upper story. And interestingly enough, the upper story, what would be like the second floor of another home, was called the Matronae. And this was the area of the church that was reserved for women only at one time. And they were always on an upper level. But the interesting history, as I say, of the church, it covers so many periods, literally 1,100 years, of architecture and sculpture and the floors, the absolutely amazing floor, glorious mosaic and marble floors that were done in this church. And you almost like want to sidestep. How can I walk down the aisle without stepping on the floor? I mean, they're so utterly beautiful. And you'd love to go into an artistic, we don't have the time to go into the artistic aspect of the church. I just really would like people just to get on the tram and go out there and see this, because it is a very special church, again, because of that history. But also, interestingly enough, in this church is the burial place of Pius IX. Now, we know after St. Peter, he is the second longest reigning pontiff. And what is interesting about his burial place, he just wanted to be, he loved this church. He loved the three saints buried there. He wanted to be buried in a very simple tomb and as close as possible to the saint to whom he was very devoted. Well, the people of Rome thought otherwise. And so the Catholics from around the world felt that he should be honored in a fashion befitting his amazing papacy. So they felt he should be remembered with grandeur, and grandeur it was, if you have ever seen his tomb. Once you get down there, and I recommend going in the morning, that's about the only time there's a guardian there that will actually take you down. There's a grate in the church, gated door, and you have to have the guardian open this for you. It's just not open to anyone who goes. And I discovered guardians are there, seem to be there more in the morning than at any other time. Anyway, you get down in this tomb. It is just astonishing. And the senses swim with color and the brilliance of the mosaics, the precious stones used, the metals, every square inch of the hall as you walk in of the tomb itself is just covered. So you have ruby reds and fiery golds and glittering
gorgeous
greens. It really, really is. The senses, you just have to stand back and say, oh my word. But there also, one very special thing which struck me were mosaics on the entrance wall. I found these particular five worthy of note. There's medallions picturing St. Alphonsus de Liguori and St. Francis de Sales, of course, patron of all of us who are journalists and writers. And he proclaimed both of them, Pius IX did, doctors of the church, so that's why they are figured in these medallions. Then there's a medallion which is a homage of the Christian world honoring Pius IX on his priestly jubilee. The fourth medallion is his proclaiming the definition of the dogma of the Immaculate Conception. And then the fifth medallion defines the dogma, not defines, honors the definition of the dogma of papal infallibility. So it's a church where, to be honest, 2 hours would just begin to scratch the surface. If you're interested in learning the history of the different basilicas, of the men, the papacies who built him, Pius IX. Oh, my word, that's a half an hour right there. So it's a church that, unfortunately, people don't know as much about, and I hope they make an effort when they're in Rome. It was one of the seven churches that I highlighted as one of the major stopping points. This is the fifth patriarchal basilica, is one of the major stopping points for the Jubilee year.
Well, from what you said, the church would certainly seem to bring all the history of the church into the present.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's the first millennium of art, of the men of the church. I mean, of Constantine, who allowed Christians to freely practice their faith. And then of two popes, of a third pope being buried there. He came later on. But the first 1,000 years, there's the various renovations, additions, embellishments. And you can just step in to this basilica and see the 1,000 years of art. Architecture, sculpture, but how they've evolved.
But there's also a value, I think, in these old churches where you've got different saints buried. When you've got the tomb, there's a sort of realization that, hey, he or she was real.
Right.
You can be in touch, you feel that you're in touch with them.
Very, very special. And then there's all sorts of wonderful stories that come up linked with them. Maybe the original story, of course, is always linked to their death, how they died, were they martyrs. But I mean, even it is said after his death that St. Lawrence appeared to one of the monks. And there is an altar in the chapel of St. Cyriaca, and a white marble altar, and there's a legend that says that St. Lawrence appeared to a monk and told him, for every Mass celebrated at this altar, a soul would enter heaven. I mean, you know, wouldn't you want to take all your monks and have someone say a Mass every hour on the hour?
Sure.
I would.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Joan.
Thanks to Joan Lewis and to Sister Janet Ferns for that summer special. That's all from the English feature programme and from me, Linda Bordoni, today. But we will be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.